Coming up this week on Breaking Badness, we're excited to bring you the latest installment of our book club series. Dmitry Alperovitch joins us to discuss his book, World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. With that, Breaking Badness is next. Welcome to Breaking Badness special book club episode recorded on April 25th, 2024. I'm your co-host, Callie Fensel, and with me is CEO of Domain Tools, Tim Chen, and our very special guest, Dmitry Alperovitch, Executive Chairman of the Silverado Policy Accelerator and co-founder of CrowdStrike. Welcome, everybody. It's great to have you both here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Tim, you were particularly interested in this topic. I was wondering if you'd share with our audience why it's so meaningful to you.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate you letting me join this morning. And Dmitry, thank you for making time for us. So yeah, this topic is meaningful for me. And because it's my namesake, would tell you my dad is Chinese. And the reason that I'm here in the U.S. is because my dad's family was in the Chinese government prior to the communist takeover in 1949. And my great-grandfather was actually the Chinese ambassador to Germany during World War II, and later to the countries of Belgium, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina, where he lived out his life and he's buried. And his family fled to Taiwan during the revolution. And then my grandmother took my dad and his brother to the U.S., where they were raised and where they stayed. And that's why I'm here and why I was raised here. But I still have family back in Taiwan. So I'm keenly interested to hear Dmitry's commentary on the Chinese threat to Taiwan here in 2024. And just wanted to pass along that intersect to this topic for me personally. And appreciate you letting me join today and super excited to hear what Dmitry has to say.
Amazing. We've known each other a long time. I didn't know this story. Really phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you so much for sharing, Tim. I think our listeners are really going to appreciate that context. So we will let's start at the beginning, because I think there's a lot of folks in our industry, Dmitry, that are familiar with your work. But just in case, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I've been in the industry a long time, retired sort of from the industry in 2020 after we took CrowdStrike public, and wanted to focus on giving back to this country. I'm an immigrant to this country, and this country has been incredibly good to me. And I feel passionate about making sure that this century, like the last one, remains an American century that is going to be good for American citizens, American businesses, American consumers. And I'm very passionate about the threat that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Republic of China, in Taiwan more specifically, but the broader implications of that to us here in America. And I spent the last 15 years of my career really fighting nation state threats, including most prominently from China, intrusions into U.S. industries and broader Western industries, stealing of intellectual property, stealing of national secrets. So I've been focused on this from a cyber perspective, but with the geopolitics lens for a very long time. And then in 2020, started a think tank that we call Silverado Policy Accelerator, which is a nonprofit that is focused on how do we maintain American prosperity and leadership in the century and beyond, focusing specifically on great power competition with China, some with Russia as well. I've been spending a lot of my time in the last couple of years, as you might imagine, on the war in Ukraine and visiting that country and working with their leadership on military strategy and the like. But a lot of my time is on China, Taiwan. And this is what this book is all about, is how do we win what I think is a new Cold War, Cold War II, as I call it in the book, and how do we deter a devastating potential conflict with China over Taiwan that we could see as soon as 4 years from now.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very noble aspirations to, you know, to work toward for this country. I was interested, you know, as you know, I watched a presentation you gave at Cornell, you know, talking about you know, this topic. And I was wondering, you know, given your background with CrowdStrike and cybersecurity, what came first, the interest in history and geopolitics or cybersecurity? Did one influence the other?
You know, they were kind of developing in parallel. Since a very young age, I've always been a news junkie. I've always been interested in history and books on history and geopolitics. And I kind of got into cybersecurity by accident because of my dad. My dad was a nuclear physicist in Russia, working on advanced simulators for nuclear power plants, particularly in the wake of Chernobyl. How do you train the workforce to operate nuclear power plants securely? And when we immigrated to the United States, he couldn't get a job in the nuclear industry, and the nuclear industry has been in a deep freeze for many decades. So he got a job as a programmer, still in the energy sector, but not necessarily the most intellectually stimulating job. And he got interested sort of as a side hobby in cryptography, public key encryption. This was sort of early to mid-90s, was just really developing, and particularly this new algorithm called elliptic curve cryptography has appeared, which was very deeply rooted in mathematics and number theory, and he had an applied math background. So he was really interested in it from the perspective of the elegance of the math. And I saw, even though I was still in high school, sort of a commercial opportunity there. And we started a small company that tried to productize these encryption-based technologies. And that's what kind of got me hooked on cybersecurity, coming from a cryptographic perspective. But very quickly, I realized that cryptography was not a solution, although it's certainly an important ingredient of cybersecurity. But at the end of the day, this is a cat and mouse game where you have adversaries, whether they're criminal groups or hacktivists or nation states, they're trying to break in and trying to evade all of your defenses. And cryptography was not going to solve that problem because, you know, if someone steals your keys, it doesn't matter how secure your algorithms are. And that actually had a much bigger appeal to me than cryptography once I sort of grasped that concept, because I felt that it was like a lot like chess. And I'm an avid chess player, although I've gotten a bit rusty, haven't had as much time to play. But this idea that it's not just about you and the capabilities you built, that you always have to think a couple of moves ahead, always think about the adversary that always has a move to play, and they're going to have a response to whatever you do, that I found just really intellectually stimulating and interesting, and that's what got me into cybersecurity. But even as I was studying in college, I was still very passionate about international affairs. I took a lot of courses in international affairs, almost got a minor, but at some point decided that it was time to graduate, and didn't have quite a few enough courses to get a minor, but took many.
That's okay. I think we can call that a concentration in
one. Yes.
I was curious, you know, based on your experience, do you feel like you had mentioned that understanding the adversary's motivations are and where they're headed, that's fundamental to cybersecurity. Do you feel like defenders fully embrace that notion, or is there room for improvement?
I think it's changing. You know, when we started CrowdStrike, we had this tagline that at the time people thought was very controversial. I never understood why, because to me it was always obvious, but the tagline was, you don't have a malware problem, you have an adversary problem. In other words, it's not about the technical specifics of a threat of a, you know, piece of malware or an exploit that is being used against you. It's about who is behind that. And, you know, today they use this piece of malware, tomorrow it'll be something else. It doesn't really matter, but you're facing a threat actor and they're trying to break into your networks for a very particular purpose. And you need to understand, what are they trying to do? How do you secure against that threat? And chasing malware, chasing exploits is really a losing proposition, because there'll always be something new, something unknown, they'll pop up. And I think there's a much broader appreciation for that. And, you know, the success of Domain Tools, Tim's company, is a testament to that, because, of course, you guys are deeply in that understanding of the broader campaigns that are taking place and using the internet infrastructure that the actors use to understand that. But that is, I think, really vital to understanding how to defeat adversaries by understanding their motivations, their capabilities, what they're ultimately after. And it's not to say that, you know, the specifics are not important. It's just that you can myopically be focused on that. And we got a ton of criticisms early on from people across industry saying that's a distraction, you know, attribution is irrelevant. And I think now there's been a much broader acceptance, although I don't think it's yet universal, that it is a vital component of cybersecurity. It's not an either or. It's not that you completely have to ignore the technical specifics and just focus on attribution, but you can't do the other either.
Exactly. I feel the same way. Let's talk about the book. That's why we're here today. What would you say was the catalyst in why you decided to write this book?
So I've been focused on this issue of China again for many years. Yeah. In fact, you know, the defining moment in my career was actually in 2010 when I was still at a company called McAfee, at the time one of the largest cybersecurity players. I was running their global threat research and investigations. And I got a call from Google, who had just been hacked by China, and they wanted to cooperate with us because a number of McAfee's customers were impacted in that incident as well. And ultimately named it Operation Aurora. It was the first time that the public sort of became aware that you had nation-state actors that were breaking into private companies, stealing intellectual property. I thought it was a completely watershed event. It literally a year later led me to found CrowdStrike. But at the same time, I was also really, really upset that the U.S. government was ignoring this problem. And it's not that they weren't aware of what was going on. You know, they had all this classified intelligence of what China was doing. So at the most senior levels, they knew about the problem, but they wouldn't talk about it publicly. In fact, at the time, you couldn't get a senior government official or any government official, in fact, to use the word cyber and China even in the same sentence. For whatever reason, they thought that that would be provocative, that it would somehow compromise our sources and methods. Of course, now we're doing it every day and with no downside. But I was having these conversations post-Aurora and other investigations I did at the time, Night Dragon, Shady Rat. And I remember sitting in the Situation Room in the White House really saying, folks, like, this is a massive problem. They're stealing everything we've got. This is, I coined this phrase at the time that's been now repeated often, this is the greatest transfer of wealth in history, what China is doing to our industry, to our economy. And everyone was like, okay, Dimitri, you know, let's not use hyperbole. We'll out-innovate them. That was literally the comment that was made to me. We are the best and brightest. We'll always be better. And I thought that was unbelievably naive, if not condescending, to people in China, who, of course, are just as bright as we are. And I always thought that, particularly using my experience from the Soviet Union, understanding that history, that you can absolutely steal and innovate at the same time. In fact, you know, counterexample I used at the time is the atomic bomb, where the Soviets stole the designs from the Manhattan Project and then replicated that initial atomic bomb in 1949, but then later developed their own designs for the hydrogen bomb, innovating, right? And stealing just helps you to shortcut to that innovation. In fact, that's what we've seen in China, where, you know, companies like Huawei now and Baidu and TikTok and their battery industry, their EV industry, a lot of those companies were initially benefiting from stolen intellectual property enabled by cyber IP theft. And now they're producing products that are arguably some of the best in the world, certainly in EVs, certainly in batteries, certainly in telecom with Huawei. And it's not an accident because, you know, you got smart people, you're stealing all these research designs, you're going to iterate on them a lot faster than Western competitors, and add on top of that the unfair trade practices, the price dumping, and overcapacity and everything else that they're doing, and they're going to win. And I was very passionate about that early on, and I felt like this is something that we absolutely have to focus on. Well, now it's becoming much more common sense. And the reason I wrote this book, to give you a very long-winded answer to your question, is because I'm now concerned not just about losing to China economically. because I think that risk is actually fairly low. They can still dominate a lot of our industries. But I'm worried about what that dependence on Chinese technology will mean in terms of Taiwan and avoiding and deterring a conflict over Taiwan. And the catalyst for my decision to actually sit down and write this book, which took 2 years, was the war in Ukraine. I was one of the first geopolitical analysts to have predicted that Putin was going to invade Ukraine about 3 months before it happened. At the time, widely criticized for my prediction as being hyping up the threat by many sort of the deans of foreign policy establishment here in D.C. Unfortunately, I was proven right, and I felt pretty passionate that it was time to warn the nation, to warn the world, that we've got an even more disastrous conflict ahead of us. And if we don't act quickly, we're going to be in a world of hurt. A conflict with China or allowing them to dominate Taiwan will have unbelievably far-reaching ramifications for American prosperity, American dominance, American security. And that's what this book is really all about.
Dimitri, if I could ask a question on this, because this is actually one of the topics that I was really interested in talking about, which is the why behind writing the book. Because obviously here in 2024 and recently, you have access to the people in Washington, for example, who need the information that you have and the knowledge that you have and the insight that you have and are in a position, I'll say this as someone who's very far outside of DC, to actually do something about it. So we're past this first point where they weren't paying enough attention or trying to ignore the threat. So clearly they're kind of there now. It was this book more because you feel like people in and around government who are in a position to do something about it, leaders of perhaps technology companies and political leaders, still are chasing and not getting ahead of how the worldview and the geopolitical landscape is changing? Or is it more for, I'm going to call it the masses, you know, people like me who have an interest in the topic, who just want to get more up to speed on the geopolitical landscape, but aren't necessarily kind of like in the inner circle of being able to do something about it?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Tim. And this book is specifically not written for the 300 people that are part of the DC foreign policy blob, as it's often called. Look, I see those people on an almost daily basis anyway and talk to them extensively. I don't need to write a book to reach them. This book is for the broader public, both here in this country and across our allies, to wake people up to the threat in a way that I think they're not awake today. And I will challenge your premise, Tim, because I don't think that the solutions here are exclusively for people in the White House or in the halls of Congress. Each and every one of us can contribute to increasing the deterrence against Chinese invasion of Taiwan and domination of that region. Because in part, what you've seen is that their rise to power has been enabled by who? American businesses, American intellectual property transfers, the attractiveness of the Chinese market, letting companies do really, really dumb things for both, I would argue, their own companies and the future of those companies, as well as the broader national security of this country. So the book is an attempt to be a call to action to all of us, not just our leaders in government, to think about every day what we could do to enhance that deterrence, whether you are in the cyber industry and you're battling the Chinese nation state actors and others from other countries on a daily basis, whether you're an industry executive that is thinking about your strategy of both your presence in Chinese market, how to diversify, how to build more resilient and secure supply chains. All of that is as vitally as important as very specific strategies I also outline in the book related to military strategy, defense industrial base reforms, some trade measures to respond to Chinese activity. But it's incumbent upon all of us to really confront this threat, because I truly believe it's a civilization-defining threat that we face. Because let's be very clear, a conflict with China will be unlike anything that America has seen, should we go to war with China, since World War II, and perhaps even in terms of just daily casualty numbers, potentially could even exceed that. And, of course, China is a nuclear power. We're a nuclear power. the chances that that conflict stays conventional below the nuclear threshold is not 100%. So there's really, really high stakes for all of us here. And by the way, should China invade Taiwan, even if we don't fight, that's global depression right off the bat, right? Some of the estimates are that a war with Taiwan would cost $10 trillion worth of damage just in the first year, wipe out $10 trillion. So it will impact all of us. So don't just sort of pretend, you know, put your head in the sand and say, well, the White House, the Congress will figure it out. Because frankly, if you've been paying attention for the last decade or so of American politics, there's a lot of gridlock and not a lot gets done unless there's pressure from the grassroots.
Let me, Kelly, if I can ask one more question, then I'll give the microphone back to you. Get back on point here for the book. But there's a lot, the security industry is full of, there's, I think, 3,000 companies that might go to RSA, for example, in a couple of weeks. There are the large, very large companies like CrowdStrike that I'm sure have regulatory intersect and significant information on their orientation to doing business in China. But for the rest of us, the domain tools of the world, the companies that are earlier and don't have that maturity and expertise, what advice do you have for companies like, for all of the other 2,900 companies that may have opportunities to do business in China, may have customers there that are asking for their technology or want to buy from them? Any kind of advice for the novice looking at specifically the Chinese market within the APAC arena and our approach and what we should be thinking about, the diligence we should be doing or potentially just not doing any business over there?
Well, I think I divide this question into two parts. So there's the cyber industry and then there's a broader industry. And I would say if you're in the cyber industry, think yourself as an arms dealer, even if you're just purely defensive. You've got to pick a side because you can't be sort of Switzerland and trading with everyone. And we sort of, I think, realized it early on, maybe before most people, because when we were raising our initial funding from investors back in 2011, we told them straight off the bat, we will never do business in China or Russia, and obviously Iran, North Korea, but they're sanctioned anyway. And we told them, like, make sure you, as you're underwriting your business case for investing in our company, that you're not thinking about those markets. We will not go into those markets. And that was a conscious decision because we saw really what was coming. Of course, everyone now has pulled out of Russia anyway, but I think you're going to see similar things happening with China because you have an adversary in its nation state, and in cyber in particular, the battle lines are drawn. And you can't cross them. And I think it's a very simple decision in the cyber industry. In a broader industry, it's not so simple. The market is obviously huge. But even with a huge market, I mean, you look at Apple, right? China is actively trying to limit Apple's influence in the Chinese market, encouraging the use of domestic phones and the like, because what? They see that U.S. influence can impact what they see is their national security and their objectives of trying to invade Taiwan, that, you know, the threat of sanctions, the threat of export controls can potentially deter them in a conflict. And they don't want to see that happen. They've seen what happened to Russia in terms of isolation that it has encountered after invading Ukraine. And they're trying to build their own independence. So their objective is to literally kick out American industry. In fact, there's this Directive A, sometimes called Divest from America Directive, that has recently came out publicly, that is a secret directive by the Chinese government to Chinese state-owned industries and government agencies to basically demand that over the next few years, they get rid of all American and really broader Western software and hardware from their systems and replace it with domestic chips, domestic-made equipment, domestic-made software. So that is their objective. So they're going to kick you out. And you know, you should be thinking about how do I try to make as much money as possible in the short term, but use that strategically to diversify and go to other markets. And I think that's what every industry should be thinking about right now. And in fairness, many are. Now, I don't think many are doing this now because of geopolitics. I think they're doing this because Chinese economy is in deep trouble, right? You've got 15% unemployment, growth stagnating. And on top of that, you've got this trade war that has been initiated over the last 8 years. And they're trying to move manufacturing to Vietnam, manufacturing to Mexico. Those conversations are happening in every boardroom and every executive suite across the nation. Some are moving faster, some are moving slower, but all of them are thinking about it and talking about it.
Thanks, Dimitri. I want to jump back into the book itself. One thing that was interesting to me is, as I'm reading the prologue and the introduction, which are available currently on Amazon, and I know when this releases, the book will actually have been released in its entirety, but it opens with a quote from Leo Tolstoy: "The two most powerful warriors are patience and time." And I was particularly interested in the significance of this quote because if I'm hearing it correctly, we don't have a lot of time. If this threat could be, you know, if it could come to fruition by the end of the decade. So what would you say the decision was in choosing that particular quote?
Yeah, you could look at it both ways. On one hand, you can say that we have no patience and we're out of time. This also is description really of Chinese strategy, right? It goes back to Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese leader from the 1970s after really Mao and through the early 90s, that told the Chinese nation to bide your time and hide your strength. Hide your strength, bide your time is how the quote actually goes. And no one at the time, even though that was completely public, everyone knew about it, no one at the time bothered asking the questions. Who exactly was he hiding his strength from? And what was he biding the time for? Even though it was completely obvious, right? But we just pretended to ignore that and allow China to build up its military capabilities in part because of intellectual property transfers from us. First, sold to them, not even stolen. Throughout the 1980s, we were selling military equipment to China. People have forgotten about that. Now, we stopped after Tiananmen Square in 89. But even after 89, we continued to provide them with vital IP during the Clinton administration. Some may remember there was this big scandal because the Chinese were building up their space capabilities, space launch capabilities. Their rockets kept blowing up. And the Clinton administration actually authorized American companies to provide assistance to China to figure it out. Because I thought, wouldn't it be great if Chinese had launch capability where we could send our commercial satellites into space? Well, now we don't think that's so great anymore, right? As their rockets are once again participating in a space race in this Cold War, as they're revamping their nuclear arsenal and their ICBMs, both submarine-launched intercontinental ballistic missiles as well as land-based, and we realized that that was a huge mistake. I also argue in the book that we're not yet out of time completely, that China is not in a position to invade Taiwan today. It probably won't be in position to invade Taiwan for four and a half years. And maybe we have as much as 8 years, which is sort of going to be the very likely end of Xi's at least official term in power. You know, he's up for re-election in the Chinese Communist Party system in 2027 for another 5-year term. Almost certainly, unless something dramatic happens, he's going to win that and stay in power unless, again, some health issues or something else happens through 2032. But in 2032, he's going to be 79. In their systems, it's not common to have leaders continue in power into their 80s. So unclear that he will remain as chairman of the party and holding really all the reins of power after 2032. And I think it's not just unclear to us, but it's more importantly likely unclear to him, which is why he's probably thinking of that really 2028 through 2032 as a window of opportunity. And I don't think he's penciled in date certain of invasion yet. In fact, I'm quite sure he hasn't. So we still have a lot of time to intervene, to deter him, but we just have to use it very, very wisely.
So in the prologue as well, the subheader is "A Dispatch from the Future," which paints a picture of what relations between China, Taiwan, and the U.S. might look like in the future, in late 2028 in particular. And you had said it's a fictional scenario, but what were your thoughts as you were laying it out? Because it is very detailed.
It is very detailed. I spent a lot of time in Taiwan, as well as talking to U.S. military personnel involved in this issue, Taiwanese military, and most importantly, walking the terrain and getting really an appreciation for just how difficult this invasion would be. Probably one of the most difficult military operations in history. A lot of people, I think, have this naive view that if China goes for Taiwan, it will sort of be like their D-Day, their Normandy, landing on the beaches and, you know, driving out from there onto various population points. And that's just not the reality of the terrain of Taiwan. And I spent a lot of time thinking how I would do it if I were China. And the scenario outlines, I think, one of the few ways in which they could successfully do it, which I think is important to get the realism of what's at stake here, because the stakes are very high, but also to get people to start thinking about ways to deter that, because there's certain, I think, very critical elements of that invasion, like the port of Taipei. I talk about the critical role that it would play in any conflict. Well, that port can be defended. If necessary, that port can be destroyed. And, you know, that needs to be part of the thinking, first and foremost in Taiwan itself, but also part of the broader coalition's thinking in terms of how we can help to deter this invasion and defend this island.
That's another question that I wanted to ask, though, Dimitri. You had mentioned that you were in Taiwan. I wanted to ask the other preparations that you made to prepare in writing this book. So you went to Taiwan. Did you also visit China? And can you tell us a little bit more about that experience, visiting locations to collect data to complete the book?
Yeah, I did not visit China. That would probably not be safe for me, given all the work I've done against the Communist Party over the years. Same with Russia. I'm sanctioned, actually, by the Russian government for my work on Ukraine issues in the last couple of years. But, you know, I don't think you need to go to China to understand the Chinese Party's intentions, or Xi Jinping's intentions more specifically. They're quite open about them. You know, they give speeches where they're very explicit about what they intend to do. In their view, Taiwan belongs to China, and they will take Taiwan by force if necessary. I mean, that's literally what Xi Jinping says. And the other thing he says is that this problem of Taiwan should not be left to future generations. And again, he's 70, right? So that gives you a sense of the timeline here that he's thinking about, because it's not like he's in his 20s and we've got lots of time. So, but yes, Taiwan was really vital to both understand what the leadership is thinking. And I met with most of the senior leadership of that country, understanding the terrain and talking with regular people on the street. And, you know, the one thing I think Americans do not appreciate, and Tim, you probably know this well, but the Taiwanese society has changed a lot in the last 30 years since them overturning the quite brutal dictatorship that they lived under post Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalists coming over after the loss in the Civil War. And beginning in the late 1980s and the 1990s, there's been a rethinking of their history. In fact, the ruling party in Taiwan just announced that they're going to take down all the monuments to Chiang Kai-shek across Taiwan, which is really a remarkable thing, right? Because he's been sort of the hero to the KMT party, the Nationalist Party, that is now the opposition party in Taiwan. But there's been sort of a re-understanding of that legacy of that history that, you know, he was quite a brutal dictator and a lot of people were disappeared during his reign. But there's also been a digging back into history of what it means to be Taiwanese and what Taiwan's history is, which is very distinct from China. And I write about some of that history in the book, that most people do not appreciate that there's never been a single moment in history when whoever fully controlled mainland China also fully controlled Taiwan. In fact, for much of its history, Taiwan was basically unconquerable. There have been numerous attempts to colonize it by the Portuguese, by the Spanish, by Japanese, and Han Chinese as well. now it really was successful and fully was able to conquer Taiwan until the Japanese in the 1890s, and they were able to control it through the end of World War II. At the end of World War II, Taiwan is given by the Allies to China. But of course, at that point, it is given to Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist leader of China, who's already losing China because Mao's communists are steadily taking territory. His control over China is shrinking. So as he's establishing that control over Taiwan, he really no longer fully controls China and controls it to quite a minimum extent in just a few years. So that history is really important to understand because it debunks the narrative of the CCP that Taiwan is just this breakaway province that has always belonged to China and should be part of China. And the Taiwanese people feel very passionately these days about their identity, first and foremost, as Taiwanese, not as Chinese. In fact, support for unification in Taiwan hovers today around 7%. And even though 7%, it's not clear what they actually believe, what type of unification they want, because for the longest time, of course, the official position of Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists was that we want unification, but unification means we take over mainland China. Right, so it doesn't mean that mainland takes over Taiwan, but at any rate, the tiny minority of the Taiwanese actually want unification, either in the future or immediately. It's sort of like a 1% type of scenario. So, majority of the country thinks they're a nation, believes passionately in that, is very proud of their history. The indigenous people on Taiwan are not Han Chinese; they're Pacific Islanders. And even though the majority of the population now is Han Chinese because of migrations, 70% of them trace their bloodlines to indigenous population because of intermarriages. And, you know, I'm actually convinced that if China was this Jeffersonian democracy, the freedom beacon of the world, that the Taiwanese wouldn't want nothing to do with it because, you know, just like Canada does not want to join America, even though we think it's the greatest country, they've got their own thing going and they're very proud of it. And so are the Taiwanese. And there's quite a bit of history in the book. There's a lot of prescriptions of what we need to do, but also how we got here and what it means that I think people will enjoy.
Dimitri, if I can jump in on this topic. If you're talking about China potentially trying to annex Taiwan, obviously in Russia, you've got a parallel situation there with the Ukraine. I'm not a geopolitician, but I would say what I learned in high school is, in general, it's been really important for the United States to have allies in trying to spread its influence. When you look at these actions that are happening and what we maybe have learned in Ukraine and some of the response that you've seen worldwide to that incursion, do you feel like in a situation in Taiwan, for example, that the U.S. in the last few years is attracting support from the areas of the world that it would need in order to try and act in the way it might want to act? And if specific to Taiwan, since that's the topic of your book, whose support do you think is the most important to give us the best chance to execute the diplomacy or outcome that we want?
You know, the best ally we've had on this, and I say this in jest, is Xi Jinping, because he's managed to turn off so many people, first and foremost in the region, but really worldwide, with his wolf-warrior diplomacy, really upsetting many countries with his unfair trade practices and the like, and most importantly, with his military buildup that is threatening everyone in the region. So when you look at Japan, that is once again militarizing and increasing defense spending. When you look in the Philippines, that for the first time in 30 years is letting American troops have bases yet again on the islands. Those are remarkable transformations. When you look at AUKUS, this alliance we have with Australia and the UK, all of those things are driven by China and the threat of China. Now, the countries in the region understand a lot better because they're closer to it and appreciate the threat to them than many in Europe that are focused on Russia, and rightly so, because they're, you know, that's the immediate threat to them. So, you know, the French, the Germans, they don't really care a whole lot about Taiwan. We saw this with President Macron when he made some unfortunate comments a couple of years ago or a year and a half ago when he was flying back from Beijing of all places and was talking about how Taiwan is not really relevant to the French. But that's fine because the people we really need are the people in the region, particularly Japan, particularly the Philippines, particularly Australia. They're going to be the ones critical for deterrence of this invasion, Europe much less so. And there we are winning those allies, not because we are so great and because they all love us. In fact, you know, many don't. But, you know, as I write in the book, we don't need to be loved and we won't be loved because, you know, no one likes the most powerful, typically, country as we are. And we don't often consider their own interests and behave in the way that they would condone. But that's fine as long as they hate China more. And today they do.
So the book is World on the Brink, coming out on April 30th. So this recording will be released on May 1st. Dimitri, can you tell us where you'll be in May? Are you touring to discuss the book, and where can people find it?
Yeah, so the book is available as of the day of this release of this recording. So you can buy it on Amazon, your favorite bookstores. I have a book website called worldonthebrink.com where you can check out some details and endorsements and also sign up for a newsletter that will advertise the different places I will be. Yes, I'll be in California. I'll be in Europe. I'll be really touring the country and giving book talks and signing away books as well. So I hope people check it out. And I hope they review it as well because the reviews are really important.
Absolutely. And before you leave today, you are also, you're not a stranger to podcasts. You actually host the Geopolitics Decanted podcast. If our listeners want to check that out, what can they expect? What sorts of topics do you discuss there?
Yeah, I started that podcast 2 years ago, right after Russia invaded Ukraine. A lot of it has been focused on that war and talking with experts about various aspects of that conflict, the military strategy, the economics, sanctions on Russia. But lately, I've been injecting a lot of China content as well. So we've been talking about the book. We've been talking about other aspects of the Cold War. Really, people will expect really deep expert analysis of the latest happenings in the world, particularly with regards to China and Russia, sort of my areas of interest and expertise in the coming months and years.
Excellent. Thanks, Dimitri. So as this is our Breaking Badness book club, you had mentioned you can find your book at any of your favorite bookstores. So I want to ask you as our guest, is there a local bookstore or library system that you support? And would you like to share, you know, what makes it so special to you?
Yeah, so in D.C., we have an institution here called the Politics and Prose Bookstore. It's an independent bookstore that where I'm actually launching this book on April 30th in a conversation with CNN's Jim Sciutto. It's a fantastic place that, you know, we should support independent bookstores. And Politics and Prose is one of those in the D.C. area.
Excellent. I'll have to check that out next time I'm in D.C. And then are there any books that particularly inspired you in your career that you'd like to share with others?
Well, I don't know about inspiring me in my career, but I do want to mention a book by a friend of mine that's also coming out soon. And I think it's very complimentary to ours. It's by a Cold War historian, Sergei Rachenko, who had gotten access to previously classified documents from Russia and China that have just recently been declassified, that give sort of the other side's perspective on the Cold War, right? There have been numerous books that have been written on the Cold War, the first Cold War, and they've all been written from Western documents, Western perspective. And this gives the other side's perspective and what they were thinking at the time, which is really, really fascinating. And it's called To Run the World. And it debunks a lot of myths that we've had about the Cold War. One of the biggest ones was related to the Cuban Missile Crisis and the assumption that we've had for so long that Khrushchev placed missiles, nuclear-tipped missiles on Cuba because he thought that Kennedy was weak and he could basically push him around, bully him around. And the documents actually reveal a very different story where he did it out of fear. And he saw the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, the attempt by the U.S. supported rebels to overturn Castro's regime. And the lesson he learned from that disaster where they got slaughtered and imprisoned was not that this was a huge mistake made by Kennedy that literally endangered his presidency in the first months of it, but that he was intent on replacing Castro and the communist regime on Cuba, and he would try it again. And he placed missiles on Cuba as a deterrence to that, a complete misreading, of course, of American politics. But sometimes that's how these things go.
And when does that book come out? You mentioned it's forthcoming.
Yeah, May 30th, so just about a month after mine. Mine is on the Second Cold War, its history and what we can do to win it. That one is on the First Cold War and how we won it.
Excellent. Cool. Tim, did you have any comments before we close out today?
Yeah, just wanted to thank Dmitry again for being so generous with his time. And I just reflecting on this conversation, I just come back to the beginning, you know, when Dmitry was talking about how he was just diving into all of these books when he was younger on world history and how that affected, you know, the trajectory of his career and how he's spending his time now. And I think that's meaningful when you think about today's day and age where people are, you know, skimming the headlines and reading what may or may not be real news in very short spurts, you know, the importance of going back and doing deep research and reading on topics of interest to all of us and how that can affect, you know, who you are and what you do. And I think Dmitry has lived that in his life. And I think if nothing else, when you think about this book and the book of the colleague that he mentioned, you know, my hope is that, you know, the outcome is the same and perhaps his as well, which is like, this is going to affect us. The next Dmitry is out there somewhere who's going to understand the importance of what he's writing about and use that, you know, hopefully in very positive ways to influence the world. So hopefully it comes full circle, and it's been fun to hear about the journey that he's had in his life, and looking forward to reading the book when it comes out on April 30th.
Thank you so much, Tim. Really appreciate it.
Well, the book again is World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. Again, Dmitry, to echo Tim, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate your time. And thank you, Tim, for joining us as well. We always appreciate hearing from you on the podcast. So thanks to our listeners for tuning in. You can find that book on Amazon or any of your favorite bookstores on April 30th. Of course, this comes out on May 1st, so it will be available for purchase on the day we publish this. So that's fantastic. But yeah, Dmitry, we hope to speak with you again in the future, and we're very excited to read your book.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. Come back again next week for an all-new episode of Breaking Badness. Catch you next time. Bye, everyone.
That's about all we have for this week. You can find us on Twitter, at DomainTools. All of the articles and IOCs mentioned today will be included in our blog post, which can be found at domaintools.com/resources/podcasts. Catch us every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time when we publish our podcast and blog. We'll see you next week on another episode of Breaking Badness. Until then, remember, don't drink and click.